Hello, and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. Today we're listening to Dr. Kevin Smith speaking about the sinking of HMAS Armidale in December 1942. This is taken from a presentation to members and guests of the Society held in Sydney on the 18th of April 2017. Dr. Smith enlisted and served in the Army during the Korean War, first becoming an instructor for the early intakes of National Service, then involved in interviewing new recruits, and he later completed a military intelligence course. But as he says, sitting on my backside, sending others off to Korea was not what I'd enlisted for. Subsequently, Dr. Smith studied and practiced in the area of institutional morale. In 1986, he wrote an official report for the Royal Australian Navy on submariner morale. He's also worked in Korea as a UNESCO consultant. Dr. Smith is active in the Armidale branch of the RSL and developed an ongoing interest in military history, including Korea and Borneo. In 2004, Dr. Smith was awarded the Order of Australia in recognition of his community service through the Lions Club and the RSL. We hope you enjoy our podcast. Here is Dr. Smith.
At your President's invitation to talk to you about the sinking of HMAS Armidale on the 1st of December 1942. But I'm going back beyond 1942. In 1798, at the Battle of the Nile, the French flagship, L'Orient, was gravely disabled. His Majesty's ship, Bellerophon, known to her crew as the Billy Ruffian, immediately was attacked by a pack of British vessels, and the fight was on. Amid the wreck and carnage of battle, the French Admiral's 13-year-old son stood bravely to his post, awaiting his father's permission to leave. The boy, Louis de Casabianca, died at his post when L'Orient's magazine exploded. In 1829, a whole generation later, Felicia Hermans wrote her poem Casabianca, beginning with the words,
"The boy
stood on the burning deck, whence all but he had fled. The flame that lit the battle's wreck shone round him o'er the dead." Every Australian schoolboy growing up in the 1920s and the 1930s, a century later still, heard about, and occasionally maybe even read that poem, although few of us ever remembered the details. However, many impressionable young minds absorbed its powerful message. Young Edward Sheehan, growing up amid the green farmlands and the forests of Barrington, south of Ulverston in Tasmania, was one of those who almost certainly would have known the first line of this poem. In 1916, at the Battle of Jutland, ship's boy John Travers Cornwall, serving on HMS Chester, stood to his duty when all others in his gun turret had been killed. This 16-year-old boy died at his post. Awarded the Victoria Cross posthumously, he became another role model for that same generation of Australian schoolboys. In March 1942, the RAN sloop Yarra, on convoy duty in the Timor Sea, heading south to Fremantle, was attacked by a squadron of Japanese heavy cruisers with supporting destroyers. Yarra was disabled, but continued firing until the captain gave the order to abandon ship. Just minutes after giving this order, Lieutenant Commander Robert Rankin was killed when a salvo of 8-inch shells destroyed the sloop's bridge. As the ship sank, leading seaman Ronald Taylor, already known as a keen and courageous sailor, manned a 4-inch gun and continued to fire as the waves closed over his ship. The story of leading seaman Taylor's bravery would surely have spread later among sailors of the RAN on shore leave in Darwin. Out of that ship's company of 151, 34 men of HMAS Yarra were able to take to Kali floats. Of these, just 13 were rescued alive. The 21 who perished during 5 days adrift were said to have either died of exhaustion or lost their sanity, providing a meal for the sharks. And that brings us now to HMAS Armidale. The loss of the Armidale was one of the most painful and bitter episodes in the history of the RAN, declared the Australian Defence Force Journal in 2002. Built at Mort's Dock, Sydney, HMAS Armidale was launched on the 23rd of January 1942, one of 60 Bathurst-class corvettes built in Australian shipyards during the war, four of which went to the Royal Indian Navy. 186 feet in length, with a beam of 31 feet, they were designed to be the tough, versatile little inshore workhorses of the fleet, and they were armed with several Oerlikon 20mm anti-aircraft cannon. They were capable of rapidly deploying small groups of troops and normally carried a complement of about 80 naval men. The Armidale performed escort duties around the eastern and northern Australian coasts and in Port Moresby waters, ready to defend convoys in three dimensions, from submarines, against surface ships, and against aircraft. Some of her classmates performed survey and minesweeping duties. However, it's to be noted that these ships could not really absorb much damage from enemy attack. She was part of the 24th minesweeping flotilla. Now, Darwin had been subject to fairly constant air attack since the 29th of February 1942. HMAS Armidale arrived in Darwin on the 7th of November 1942. Soon she was ordered with another corvette, HMAS Castlemaine, to proceed to Batano Bay in Timor. Leading seaman Boole, a name we don't hear, but leading seaman Boole was a greatly experienced sailor, and he displayed exceptional foresight before Armidale sailed out of Darwin. He organised the retrieval of dunnage lying around the wharf area, and this was lashed to the deck of HMAS Armidale. Just a few hours out of Darwin, on the 7th of November, just a few hours out of Darwin, both ships were detected by Japanese aircraft, but were signalled by Darwin headquarters to continue their mission. They were joined by the small HMAS Kuru, and the operation was named Operation Hamburger. HMAS Armidale was carrying a crew of 83 plus three AIF men, Bren gunners, to provide covering fire on the beach for two Dutch officers and 61 Netherlands East Indies troops who were to be put ashore at Batano Bay. Serving as loader on the aft port Orlikon of Armidale was ordinary seaman Edward Sheehan. Each Orlikon was served by a gun crew of three or four. The gun chief, who found the targets. The gunner, strapped to his weapon with a waist belt and held firmly by shoulder supports, whose job it was to hit the enemy targets. The loader, who fed ammunition drums of what I think were 0.75-inch rounds, 20mm rounds, to the cannon, with sometimes a second loader. Each gun crew member trained to serve in all three positions. Kuru arrived early at Batano Bay on the 29th of November, and it took off about 80 Portuguese refugees, men, women and children, later transferring them at sea to Castlemaine, which then proceeded back to Darwin. Kuru then turned back to Timor. When Armidale reached her destination at Batano Bay that night, she could not locate signal fires as had been arranged. She withdrew back to sea to try again the next night to land the Netherlands East Indies, that is Indonesian soldiers. On the 30th of November, Armidale was attacked by an enemy bomber, and then by high-level formations of nine or ten bombers. She fought back strongly and suffered neither damage nor casualties. This was reported to Darwin, where Commodore Pope arranged for protective air cover. Armidale came under persistent air attack again the next morning, having been spotted at 1300 hours on the 1st of December. The location was 110 degrees south, 126 degrees 30 minutes east. Now, don't expect to remember that, but this may be available in written form in due course. 110 kilometres off the southern coast of Timor. By 14:30 hours, there were 12 enemy aircraft, 9 torpedo dive bombers, and 3 Zero fighters coming in low at 300 miles per hour. An enemy float plane was apparently observing close by. Armidale zigzagged with vigorous manoeuvres, the deck tilting, pitching, while there was a steady response from her Orla Kanaka cannons amid the fierce clatter of machine guns. About 400 kilometres from Australia, she had no aircraft. One enemy dive bomber and one fighter were shot down during these lengthy attacks. The torpedo dive bombers were a new factor not previously encountered in those strife-worn, torn waters north of Australia. It was at approximately 15 hours when the ship was hit by two torpedoes, both on the port side. The first exploded just forward of the bridge, destroying much of the radio room. Lansbury was piping abandoned ship on the captain's orders when he saw Sheehan strapping himself back into his Orlikan. Historian Graham Wilson has calculated that Sheehan could have been firing for only 16 to 33 seconds, the maximum rate of fire being 450 RPM, rounds per minute, with one magazine holding only 60 rounds. From the moment he strapped himself in, Sheehan knew he was going to die. Single-handedly, he took on the attacking aircraft, bringing down one of them and perhaps damaging two others. He continued firing and he died at his post, already wounded and now shockingly wounded a second time as bullets slashed open his chest and back. Armidale was fully under the waves by 15:20 hours. Torpedoes hit at 15:15. Having taken an estimated 3 minutes to go down. She was the only Bathurst class corvette to be sunk by enemy action. The surviving soldiers and sailors endured further Japanese attacks. For days on end, they suffered from the tropical sun, sea snakes and sharks, hunger, thirst, from their wounds and from the cruel sea. The rescue efforts out of Darwin have been criticised as complacent, piecemeal and far too late. What followed the early radio signals before the first torpedo struck merely indicated attack by bombers without specifying dive bombers or torpedo bombers. This led to erroneous assumptions back in Darwin for earlier experience of high-level bombing at sea showed it had rarely been particularly effective. Darwin headquarters had seemed to ignore the loss of radio contact, apparently assuming that Armidale must have survived the high-level attacks while still maintaining radio silence. The captain, Lieutenant Commander David Richards, exhausted but still in fighting spirit, the only unwounded officer reasonably able to navigate, loaded the wounded into Armidale's motorboat and headed for Darwin. On the 5th of December, they were rescued by HMAS Kalgoorlie. There were 17 survivors out of the 22 who had left the carnage of the sunken corvette. The ship's whaler, or lifeboat, was full of bullet holes and waterlogged, but not sinking. The remaining survivors formed a tow line, a damaged Carly float leading, followed by the whaler, and then a makeshift raft. They had some oars or paddles, but they also had to use their hands. After 3 days, they had not progressed beyond Armidale's oil slick. What followed was a memorable example of resourcefulness and determined effort. They had to turn the whale boat over and haul its stern, the most damaged part, up onto the improvised raft. They had no firm base for leverage. They had to tread water as they persisted in their efforts to manhandle the heavy lifeboat, first of all, to get it upside down. Then, inch by painful inch, with the tropical sun beating down on their heads, immersed again and again, their May Wests fully inflated as they pushed upwards, they moved their boat very slowly over the edge of that flimsy raft. And the raft kept slipping away as it tilted under the added weight of the whaler. We know too little of the details of this episode of their tenacious survival. They crammed the bullet holes with pieces of their underpants. There was some canvas that could be lashed over the hull. Even so, constant bailing with 3 steel helmets was necessary. These resourceful RAN sailors had repaired their bullet-ridden whaler by December the 4th and headed southeast for Darwin on the 5th. With 29 on board, commanded by Lieutenant Lloyd Palmer, who had served as gunnery officer on Armidale. Painfully sunburned, their limited food and water rapidly diminishing, those in the whaler slowly progressed towards Darwin. Some men became delirious, hallucinating. A few shouted they could see breakers on the coastline. When it rained, they caught water in their open mouths and in the folds of their May West life jackets. On December the 8th, they were sighted by a searching Catalina, which dropped food, and they were picked up by HMAS Kalgoorlie on December the 9th. Arrived in Darwin the following day, the 10th, 9 days after the sinking. Theirs was one of the great see survival dramas of World War II. The Javanese soldiers and the Dutch officers were given the Kali float and the raft. The East Indies soldiers on the raft became separated from the others. I found no further reference to the Kali float. Those on the raft were sighted and photographed by a Catalina aircraft on December the 7th. On December the 8th, food was dropped to the raft, but they were never seen again. They drifted away into oblivion. The stories of other survivors barely or never mention them. They simply disappeared without a trace. Most likely, the flimsy construction had broken up in the sea. There have been occasional but very persistent suggestions that a Japanese submarine was involved in their disappearance. Tom Lewis, naval historian and former naval officer, effectively dismisses this furphy in his book Honor Denied on pages 183 to 185. Out of the ship's company of 83, 40 died or were killed in action. The three AIF Bren gunners survived. The two Dutch officers died or were killed in action. Of the 61 Javanese troops, 58 died or were killed in action. Out of a total 149 soldiers and sailors on Armidale, there were just 49 survivors. Perhaps statistically, not quite as devastating as the disaster that overtook HMAS Yarra. However, we most certainly applaud the naming of a Collins-class submarine as HMAS Sheehan. Perhaps the courage of ordinary seaman Teddy Sheehan is the better known part of the story of HMAS Armidale. However, there's a lot more to the Armidale story than Sheehan's magnificent, courageous self-discipline. Leading seaman Bull, do you remember him? Burned raw by the tropical sun, arrived unannounced at his Sydney home on Christmas Eve, 1942. His wife and two children had not known whether he was alive or dead. What a marvellous Christmas present for that family. As the Armidale sank beneath him, he had dived over the side and swum astern as fast as he could. He told his wife that as the stern of the ship lifted high in the air, its propellers still turning, he saw a Jap bomber hit by Teddy Sheehan skimming above the surface, trailing smoke until it hit the water with a mighty splash. Lee Bull had served 8 years in the RAN by 1942. Earlier in 1942, he had been attached to the depot ship HMAS Cuttable in Sydney Harbour. When it was torpedoed by Japanese midget submarines, he'd been ashore on leave. Soon afterwards, he was drafted to the cruiser HMAS Perth. But his orders were cancelled on the day before she set sail on her final voyage north, where Perth was sunk in the Sunda Strait off Java. was in the same month that Yarra went down. Boole had been transferred then to HMAS Canberra. As she steamed north to the Battle of the Coral Sea, where she was sunk, Lee Boole had been yet again transferred at sea to HMAS Armidale. At last, on the 1st of December 1942, his destiny caught up with him, but he survived. The president of your Naval Historical Society, Captain David Michael, has recently been granted access to a diary, possibly written by Lee Boole, but that is still being explored, I believe, and perhaps in the future we shall hear more of this. Another survivor, Ordinary Seaman Colin Madigan, was in Armidale for the 1988 dedication of the HMAS Armidale Memorial in that city's Central Park. He was there again for the 60th anniversary of the sinking in 2002. Madigan recalled survivors clinging to whatever they could in the sea among the oil and the blood during the first hours after the sinking. Many had been badly injured. He recalled sea snakes swimming around their heads. Sharks brushed past their dangling legs, feeding upon the dead and the injured. He recalled survivors lashing together pieces of flotsam to make a raft as Japanese aircraft returned to strafe. Madigan told how the whaleboat was hauled aboard HMAS Kalgoorlie. As it was hauled aboard, it fell apart. Of 29 who had set out in the whaleboat, 27 were still alive, badly blistered and suffering exposure. Let us hear briefly too from some of the other survivors. Corporal Lionel Clark, one of the three AIF men. Things got so bad with the Netherlands East Indies soldiers refusing to give the rest of us a fair go that the Dutch officers threatened to shoot them. Stoker Ray Raymond, who was in Armidale in 2002 for the 60th anniversary, had some gruesome memories. Now, if you can't stand gruesome, block your ears. Joe Curry floated near us for several days. Sometimes the sharks would nudge him from underneath and take a bit out of him, but he stuck around just the same. His head had been shot off, but I knew that it was Joe because of the ring on his finger. On his successive visits of remembrance to Armidale each December the 1st, I came to know Ray rather well. He told me most assertively, Sheehan shot down a Japanese plane. Telegraphist Dennis Reedman, one of those driven into a crazed state of mind, I started to jump over the side, so that I could swim the Circular Quay. Roberts grabbed me and gave me a bloody great whack on the jaw. I came to lying on the bottom of the boat, sobbing my heart out. A crewman of HMAS Kalgoorlie never forgot the sight of survivors collapsing on the deck of his ship. Their condition was appalling. With sunburnt, blistered, and ulcerated skin, caked in fuel oil and salt, they were wrinkled up like prunes. The survivors appear to have received little consideration or care back in Darwin, and they were moved back home, in some cases by slow-moving troop trains. When ordinary seaman Caro and two mates reached Sydney, our hair was still matted with oil. We were unshaven and we looked pretty haggard. Frank Walker wrote his book, HMAS Armidale, The Ship That Had to Die, in 1990. In it he gave details of the subsequent wartime naval inquiry, and he is scathing of the treatment of the men of HMAS Armidale. He wrote, "The unpalatable but inescapable truth is that the operation was botched up and then covered up." That is, any rescue operation. There have been representations made that Sheehan deserved a VC and that it should now be awarded posthumously. Many such requests have emanated from Tasmania, his home state, but all have been unsuccessful. The simple truth is that recommendations of VCs for World War II naval personnel, men serving in His Majesty's Australian ships, have had to be approved by the British Admiralty. But we're now seeing the birth of a legend among the citizens of Australia's Southern Island. Not so much relating to an honour denied, although there's plenty of that too, but a legend akin to that of Leonidas, the valiant Spartan who defended the pass at the head of 300 warriors against a vast Persian army during the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC in ancient Greece, so many centuries ago. Our own new Australian legend is of a great Australian naval warrior who died in unwavering, single-handed defence of his ship. And that legend will assuredly spread and grow in the years ahead. I say to you, let us nurture that legend. It is very pleasing to see this year that the New South Wales RSL has chosen to honour Teddy Sheehan with its annual card and lapel pin. $5. The lapel pin portrays HMAS Armidale. The card to which it is attached, Teddy Sheehan. Where and how that RSL decision arrived, I don't know. But as far as my talk is concerned, I consider it most opportune that we are here tonight remembering Teddy Sheehan and HMAS Armidale, and the RSL on Monday will be making, if it is not already doing so. In 2002, I went to sea out of Darwin on HMAS Whyalla to conduct research on behalf of the Deputy Maritime Commander, RAN. We sailed into the Arafura Sea and westward to the Ashmore Reef. But I guess that adventure is a story for another time. I came home somewhat inspired to do something about perpetuating the name of HMAS Armidale. And immediately our Armidale sub-branch RSL took up the challenge, and I found myself chairing a small committee of former sailors. The mayor and the local federal member proved to be very strong supporters. The local press promptly came on board, and soon we had the backing of an entire community. That community, Armidale, in northern New South Wales. An RSL secondary school's art competition on the theme Our Pride in the Courage of HMAS Armidale received a DVA grant, and the principal judge was survivor Colin Madigan, the former Minister for Defence and Minister for New England, the Honourable Ian Sinclair, and the RSL's national president at the time, Major General Peter Phillips, gave most influential support behind the scenes to support our campaign. We were elated to be successful in our endeavours for a new HMAS Armidale. But more than that, on the occasion of the 60th anniversary of the sinking, the Chief of Navy announced that the next more versatile and larger generation of 12 Australian naval patrol boats would be known as the Armidale class. A contract had been signed with Defence Maritime Services near Fremantle, and construction had been started on the lead vessel, HMAS Armidale. And that this first of the new class would be launched, although not commissioned, the following year. In 2005, members of the Armidale RSL sub-branch, with the mayor and his wife, travelled to Darwin for the commissioning of HMAS Armidale on the 24th of June. Two survivors from 1942 were there, Roy Cleland and Will Lambshed. This patrol boat continues today in service with the RAN. In response to widespread public opinion that Teddy Sheehan should have been awarded a Victoria Cross, the Defence Honours and Awards Appeals Tribunal was instructed by the Australian Government to thoroughly investigate the matter, or perhaps reinvestigate the matter. There were numerous submissions to the tribunal. Some were quite brief assertions of support for such an award. The RAN Corvettes Association made a very strong submission. Wireman Will Lambshed stated to the tribunal, "A torpedo struck our port side amidship, causing a huge wall of water. The doorway burst open, and I stepped into it, which took me over the side. I was a man overboard. With a ringside position to witness the sinking as the ship broke into two halves. The rear section was leaning at an angle to port when the Oerlikon started firing. I saw tracer bullets hitting a Zero, which flew over my head and hit the water some distance away. I learned later it was Teddy Sheehan who had strapped himself into the gun and shot down the Zero. To me, this had to be one of the bravest things that could be recorded. Teddy Sheehan will always be a hero to me." Ordinary Seaman Ray Leonard, after the war, eventually became the chief psychologist of the Department of Veterans Affairs. His evidence was quite clear. Struck by a torpedo, Armidale almost immediately developed a list to port and began to sink. On my way down from the bridge to the starboard deck, a group of us tried unsuccessfully to launch the whaler. I abandoned ship by jumping off to starboard, and as I did so, I heard, in addition to the enemy's machine gun fire, a different sound, which I recognised as coming from Armidale's Orlican. I met up with my shipmate, Ordinary Seaman Russell Caro, subsequently, and Caro expressed to me his admiration for Sheehan's heroic behaviour. During the 6 months that we were shipmates on Armidale, and during our friendship over many post-war years, I regarded Russell Caro as a man of great integrity. Ordinary Seaman Donald Pullen told the Inquiry, "I recall how Ted's first movement was towards the ship's side, as if to jump into the sea. But Ted was wounded at the same time, his first wound. He did an about turn, struggled to the after Orlican, and strapped himself in and began firing. He had at least one kill and another plane damaged, which disappeared into the sea in the distance. He'd have little hope of escape, particularly if he was wounded again." Colin Madigan was commissioned as an RAN sub-lieutenant in 1945. Then, as a civilian, he resumed his pre-war architectural studies and eventually became one of Australia's most distinguished architects, especially noted for his design of the National Gallery and the High Court in Canberra, and some of the buildings of the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Madigan's statutory declaration stated, "My action station on the bridge was in the ASDIC cabinet. When the order to abandon ship was given, I had difficulty extricating myself because my Mayvest was inflated. I could hear Teddy Sheehan's Orlican firing all the time. This act was awe-inspiring. It enters that universal temple, pantheon, which records the world's greatest legends." As Ray Raymond climbed the ladder with difficulty from the engine room as the ship leaned to port, he walked down the ship's starboard side to reach the sea. He informed the Inquiry, "I swam about 40 yards away when confronted by a torpedo, which was painted red and green. How it didn't hit me, I'll never know. But it proceeded on its way and hit the ship between the engine and the boiler room, with the result that the ship was blown into two halves. The bridge section of the ship sank first. The after section righted itself from the tilt, and the after Orlican came into sight, being manned by Ted Sheehan. Many were killed as a result of the low-level attack by the Japanese, but many more would have been killed had it not been for Ted Sheehan's brave action and sacrifice of his own life." Able seaman Ted Pellett's statement indicated that, "Sheehan and I were both together. We made for the motorboat. I had a Tommy axe in my hand and I chopped the afterfall, and Sheehan was right alongside me. They were strafing us at the time. He was going to get into the motorboat with me. He was right alongside me. He made a decision to go back and have a go at them. He didn't have to do it. A lot of people would say he deserved the VC, and some would say he was a bloody idiot. It was each man for himself." In the House of Representatives, on the 20th of June 2001, the member for Braddon spoke at some length. I shall mention just a brief extract or two from Hansard. Unfortunately, Sheehan's conspicuous gallantry was only briefly recorded by his CO. The Australian Commonwealth Naval Board, headed by a seconded Royal Navy officer, had to send recommendations to the Admiralty in London. The Australian government of the day did not avail itself of its newly established powers issued by a royal warrant on the 31st of December 1942. Had it had the power to recommend the Victoria Cross. In 2013, the tribunal concluded that Sheehan's actions displayed conspicuous gallantry. But that the tribunal could not recommend the award of a VC. This finding was not particularly popular, and thousands unsuccessfully signed petitions to set the findings aside.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, over 1,200 articles from our in-house magazine, The Naval Historical Review, several online books, and a range of books, monographs, and ship plans for sale through our shop. If you've got any questions about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. You can't miss it. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation. We rely on your continuing support. Please use the website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletter. See you next time.